Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
So what if the biggest thing standing between you and the life you want isn't your talent, your money, or your circumstances? What if it's fear? Fear keeps people from asking for the promotion, starting the business, leaving the unhealthy relationship, speaking their truth, or chasing the dream they've carried for years. Today, we're talking about how to stop letting fear make your decisions and start living fearlessly. Welcome back to the show. Today, we're diving into one of the biggest obstacles to human potential, fear. And more importantly, how to transform that fear into fearlessness. Joining us is Deepak Parashar, executive advisor, global energy industry leader, and author of Life, the Spiritual Essence, and Engineer's Insights into the Integrated Nature of Divinity, international speaker and creator of the Techno-Spiritual Billionaire Leadership Series. His work is the result of 14 years of research across 38 countries, inspired by a life-changing encounter with the Dalai Lama, and shaped by conversations with more than 100 world leaders, military heroes, scientists, and spiritual teachers. And today he's going to show us why fear isn't just an emotion, it's something we can train ourselves to overcome. Deepak, welcome back to the show. It's been a little while. We're so excited to talk to you and to see what you've been up to. How are things going?
So first of all, namaste to you, Lisa, and big namaste to all our friends out there. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for this wonderful introduction. Now, to add to what you said, I am an engineer MBA, and as you said, I'm a veteran of the energy industry. I saw multiple power initiatives at differing points of the globe, working with dynamic teams in over 30 countries. And in parallel, I had conducted this experiential research into leadership and divinity, given leadership is a subtle form of divinity in itself. And as you mentioned, I was blessed to gain wisdom from over 100 leaders from myriad professions, including industry, defense, the space program, arts and entertainment, education, politics, all the while being reinforced by clergy. And as you mentioned, this entire journey began thanks to a chance meeting with His Holiness the Dalai Lama back in 2009 on a wonderful, wonderful flight to Tokyo. So this cumulatively then led into the creation of a custom leadership architecture, which I've coined as the Techno-Spiritual Billionaire Series, which I now teach and write about. And I'm now expanding this into the public space. And a key derivative of this 14-year, 38 inquiry was how fear stunts human potential. And that can range from career decisions to relationships to fear of speaking up in an organization to negotiations to mountaineering to battlefields to public speaking and then to the ultimate, which is the fear of passing away. Now, if you can intelligently work through fear and harness it into a highly controlled force, it radically shifts your thinking and your being. And so today, we're going to briefly discuss how to convert this fear into fearlessness in three scenarios: in negotiations, in company culture, or what I call institutionalized fear, and lastly, in mountaineering. So let's start with negotiations. Now, coming from the energy industry, you know, I dealt with a lot of technology leaders. And one leader, he once told me that in his estimate, it takes some 20,000 goods and services to put together a large combined cycle power plant. And so what happens, Lisa, is that when you spend, you know, 3 decades in this industry, you run into all kinds of organizations ranging from small component manufacturers to system integrators to those who manufacture the large equipment, gas turbines, boilers, from architect engineering companies to software companies to construction organizations. And so what happens is before long, you begin to understand their brush strokes. What I mean by that is you begin to understand how they operate and in particular, how they manage risk. And given this is very highly engineered, time-sensitive, custom output, very, very complex work coming together. You know, for example, a combined cycle power plant takes you somewhere between 2 to 3 years to construct. So you're looking at long-term relationships. But there's always hitches. And, you know, those have to be time managed. I mean, during my time, Lisa, my day would begin at 3:45 in the morning and sometimes go until 10 at night. And it was 7 days a week. You know, that type of rigor, because time waits for nobody and profit equals cash and everybody has objectives. So there are always hitches. And as a consequence, sooner or later, you're going to run into negotiations. Now, imagine the scenario, or rather the pressure on the two lead negotiators, one from either organization, that have come together, and they carry the hopes of their respective organizations to achieve the best possible outcome. And since pressure is fear, it's a form of fear, you will sometimes come across differing forms of early intimidation. You get set up, and that in itself is an expression of fear. But basically, each trying is the best, you know, they're all trying the best for that. I've gone through scenarios where, as forms of early intimidation, I was told to park my car at a distance from the office and then walk in the heat. And then you had to wait. And then you had to deal with the non-decision makers, you know, and then eventually the lead negotiator emerges. And now you have to contend with whatever body language and, you know, other things that he has thought of. And these are all designed to create imbalance, early imbalance through subtle fear. Now, this doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, there are times that it's going to happen, well, you know, once you've been for 30 years in this field. And many negotiations are lost long before the meeting begins, because people often concede early. You know, they get taken in. And especially when you have a 3-year run that you're going, you know, that you have to build a pipeline, and this can set a very, very powerful and a harmful precedent for, particularly in terms of long-term relationships. So what are the fear factors that these lead negotiators are protecting against? You've got fear of failing, fear of escalation. This is a big one, particularly after a major negotiation. And Lisa, we're not talking, you know, small change. You're talking multi-million dollars, where sometimes it takes a year to prepare for these negotiations, you know, or more. Mm-hmm. They're very, very, you know, intense efforts. So what happens is, if the negotiation doesn't go well, there is a lot of back channel talk that goes after. And so, you know, your reputation could be at stake. Could it hurt your job security? And I've seen this time and time again. This was during my early training days, that when two lead negotiators came inadequately prepared, you would see the actual subject of discussion being cast aside and ego would take over and they would just be going at each other's throats. And in those situations, Lisa, everybody loses. And if the negotiations do not work, this leads you into formal disputes, you know, arbitrations and this stuff. And this is where everyone loses. So coming back, you know, you want to have a win-win scenario. And so how do you achieve that? What you have to do is you have to tie the negotiations to a delicate balance of meeting or exceeding your profit objectives with integrity, while keeping in mind your quality output, the product that you have given. And what happens is, if you can do that, you now, everything goes away. You preclude doubt and fear, because one of two things happens typically. You either realize that you may have caused the problem in the first place, and therefore you're causing harm to the project, causing harm to the opposing side. There's a lot of collateral damage as a result. You're responsible for it, or you're simply being had. And usually the answer is somewhere in the middle. But the point is that you preclude fear through facts. You communicate before the meetings, within your organization, set your targets, be brutally honest about what you have done and how you can, you know, further influence the situation in the negotiations. You communicate with the people you're going to be negotiating with. You create a very healthy team spirit. And that's how you're going to win, because ultimately you will now go for the appropriate entitlement. And that's how it works.
Is there a mindset shift someone can make before walking into a difficult conversation that would help deal with that fear?
The only way I know how is to take the facts head on. You have mm-hmm. to face, and that is the basis, you know, of excellence also in our lives. You know, that if you can learn to face yourself, you know, who you are, because you see, Lisa, we all think we are, you know, I think I'm the perfect me, but in fact, everybody else is getting the real me, and the fall or the delta is the ego in the middle. So if you go through facts, face them, honestly, communicate some more, and then set up a win-win scenario, what you're really doing is, for the negotiations, you're setting up an iterative process to ultimately conserve longer-term relationships to achieve timely, excellent output. That's how you do it.
So I want to ask you about Christopher Voss's book. And so he wrote Never Split the Difference. And that book has become one of the most respected books on negotiation. Can you let us know what your perspective is on his philosophy, and where does fear fit into that conversation?
That's a great question. So first of all, as I said, successful negotiations are all about a win-win. And once you've gone through enough negotiations, particularly in these long-term relationships, what happens, Lisa, is that 100% win on one side and a 0% win on the other side never works. So what happens is that if you've been honest about the negotiations, and as I said, you've dealt with facts and you are prepared to go in on a win-win scenario, what happens is you begin to trade with the other organizations because you understand the failure metrics of the other organization and also their success metrics. So what happens is, over a period of time, and this can range from days to months, the two parties begin to trade. You know, okay, I'll give you this. You please give me that. Let's see if we can work. Here's the collateral fallout, or here are the joint or the benefits of it. And so what happens is, when you have an excellent relationship, you can usually bridge the gap and everybody walks away. But there are times that will come, but you're not able to bridge the gap. And, you know, the lead negotiators are, you know, they have their strict boundary conditions to operate in. So what happens is, sometimes you come this close and there's a gap. Now you have and neither party can move. You know, you can try, you can weave, you can bob, move, try your best, but neither party ultimately can move. If the delta is equitable, in those cases, you split the difference and walk away, instead of going or pushing it out into a formal dispute later on. So once in a while you have to do it. But again, Lisa, every negotiation is different. There is no hard and fast rule.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think what you said about just like showing up and being honest and speaking factually and not taking things personally. I think a lot of people who are really sensitive or aren't able to look themselves in the mirror, in the eye, struggle with that. And so I'm curious to know, what does a fear-based leader look like?
Well, that actually is a discussion all unto itself, but you can be sure that this person is fairly removed from the truth. And therefore, there is a lot of ego in play. There's a lot of positioning, you know, and a lot of times they are projecting themselves. They're really masking who they truly are. You know, they're
right.
And again, see what happens, Lisa, is deep down, there is intrinsic divinity in each one of us. So the pathway to excellence is to tap into that divinity. Now, you can put up all the images that you want, but, and you know, I've come across many negotiators, you know, on the other side like that, you know, who display a lot of ego. But every single time, truth always wins through. Because ultimately, they are also forced to recognize that, listen, this is going to lead to a win-win. And again, you know, there's a lot of derivative fallout from these main negotiations. For example, if he just takes a very tough position, and he doesn't budge an inch, and you are very clear about what to do, and you've spoken the truth, you've outlined everything, and the parties walk away, where do you think it's going to go? He will himself, at some point, everybody has a boss. So his own leadership will probably have to, you know, either they come in the way or they, you know, they bypass him and they say, all right, let's see, we can come to an equitable settlement. So again, you know, to your point, Lisa, you have to be able to manage all these situations, but dealing with very challenging people on the other side who will not, a lot of times they may just be positioning just to test you, right? They may actually mean very well, but they're just testing you to see if you're going to break under pressure. But when you come with facts, there's no breaking. It cuts through any boundary, any ego, any positioning that goes on. You cannot mess with facts in negotiation. And that's how you're going to win. And that's how you're going to preclude fear.
Absolutely. So let's talk about fear inside of organizations then. So fear doesn't only affect individuals, it can shape an entire workplace. How does fear quietly damage company culture?
Excellent. So that was the second point of our discussion. Now, and this is what I call institutional fear. Now, first of all, institutions are necessary. Structure matters. Discipline matters. Risk management matters. This is all designed to breed excellence in output. And yet, there are so many elite professionals, Lisa, that never fully discover themselves. And why is that? It primarily depends upon the culture of the organization and more specifically, the type of leaders that you're going to work with. Now, typically, you will come across two kinds of leaders. There are those leaders that expand their people. They encourage their growth. They help them seek new boundaries of excellence. They train them, promote them, and push them away. They promote them up and out. In the meantime, what they also do is they create this very healthy pipeline of emergent leaders to come in. So they're embellishing, they're growing their people all the time. These are the best leaders to work with. And I've had, you know, the great honor of working with many of them. Conversely, you'll find those leaders who constrain their people. They hold them down because whatever the reasons may be, they don't want to retrain new talent, you know, and they want to maintain continuity of excellence in the output. In short, they stunt the growth of their people. And this is where these many elite professionals never discover themselves. Now, what happens in the second case is that a lot of professionals make the classic mistake. They begin to look at their fear and doubt as a form of logic or practicality, where, you know, now you'll hear things like, well, perhaps I should wait. Maybe it's not the right time. Do I have the right experience? Will I be the first one to get laid off when the company reorganizes? This is a real practical, you know, thing that people go through. And this leads, Lisa, into a boundary of fear that people begin to get comfortable with. They don't want to step outside. So what's the answer? Work it backwards. As a very famous actor, George Clooney, he once said that failure is something you can deal with. And by the way, Lisa, for me, failure is only perceived failure. For me, it is simply an opportunity to go and try something else. Maybe I need to refine my skill sets, right? But this, to me, the failure doesn't exist, you know, in my mindset. But regrets is something that you cannot turn the clock back on. The answer is, as I said, work it backwards. Let go of your inner tension. Expand your thinking. Sit down with your loved ones. Sit down with your friends. Sit down with some trusted colleagues and say, look, where am I at this point in my career? And one of two things will happen. You may either, after taking all these factors, decide that staying where I am currently is the best thing for me to do. Conversely, you may say, look, I need to grow. I need to expand. I need to move out. Right. And I need to go and try different things. But the point is that in either situation, you have now precluded fear. You've precluded doubt. You've taken, if you decide to stay within where you are, be happy about it. You've taken a conscious decision because 15 years later, you won't have that regret. As you progress in your career, whatever you do, you will come across different scenarios. And each time you should sit back and assess. Get a mentor within the organization, you know, somebody who can look out for you. And, you know, with this type of help, you're going to grow. Conversely, if you need to move on, go ahead, go and seek yourself, but be fearless about it. And a lot of times I've seen is that when people stand up and say, look, these are my talents and I need to be in a different place. They get respected for what they do. That's what you have to think about. But that is how you preclude fear in either situation.
Yeah, I feel like leaders who like micromanage, like you said, they squash their employees. And then their employees are afraid to make any moves because they're not used to making any type of decisions on their own. Anytime I've been in a situation like that, I felt so confined to like, it's almost like being in a cage because you feel like you can't spread your wings. So for anyone listening who leads a team, what is one thing that they can start doing to perhaps create an environment where people feel safe enough to grow?
The answer is very simple. Lead by example. And, mm-hmm. you know, for, you know, my, in ultimately, these are my, the projects that I managed, you know, cumulatively, they ran into the billions. And I always maintained one simple rule. If we have success, the team's going to get the credit. If we fail, please come and talk to me. I'm the one responsible because I did not create the appropriate circumstances for the team to be, or the teams to be able to excel at their jobs. And I've done this many a time and I've told people, do not come after the employees. But at the same time, what I always told the teams, you know, that we think as one large mind, that whatever the problem is, you know, whether it's a team of 30 people, 40 or 50 or 100 people, the answer lies within this team, and we are going to win. We are going to help each other. If you think that your job as an engineer, for example, is boxed in, you know, within certain boundaries, think again. You are going to step over that boundary where you can to help somebody in trouble to the extent that you can. And what happens is before long, this rhythm gets set into place. Now, at the same time, what I told people is we are going to make mistakes because, again, when you're dealing in these significant projects, you know, mistakes are going to happen. Mistakes are fine. We're going to learn from it. You have nothing to fear. But be cognizant of one simple point. We are not going to make the same mistake twice because that means we have not learned from our previous mistake. And that is not acceptable. So if you go and make the same mistake, now we're going to have a very straightforward discussion.
Yeah, I like that. That's great advice. That's perfect advice. Leading by example, having integrity, showing up, saying what you're doing and doing what you're saying you're going to do. Absolutely. There's nothing more you can do. And being authentic in yourself and just being true to who you are. People can feel that. They can feel that in someone's energy and in the way that they show up in a room.
Just one last point. You know, you must have the ability to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to your people. If you can do that, you know, there's a time to speak and then there's a time to be quiet. And the frontline leader knows how to balance the two. My apologies.
That's a great point. Listening is so important. Many leaders speak a lot. And I think when people speak a lot, they're nervous or maybe it's an insecurity thing. I think it's a skill to, you know, to be quiet and listen. But it's a very important one, especially in leadership.
Yes.
I want to hear about the mountains. So you've drawn these incredible lessons from mountaineering. Can you talk about that? And what do mountains teach us about fear that everyday life absolutely does not?
I'll do so. So first of all, I'm not a mountaineer. I admire mountains. You know, I've seen Mount Everest 4 times. And, you know, I flew past Mount Everest. I've been to Mount Fuji. I love mountains. It's just, you know, it's in my nature. Now, first of all, as normal people, you know, we look at mountaineers and we say, what is going on here? I mean, look at the dangers that they're contending with. And yet, so what motivates these people? That was the question, Lisa, that came into my mind, given just about every single decision above the dead zone, you know, which is 8,000 meters and above, is a critical one. It's a life and death decision, every single one. So clearly, what occurred to me while I was doing this very intense global experiential research as an engineer into divinity is that these mountaineers are clearly channeling fear in some form. You know, as we had said earlier, that you channel fear into a highly controlled force. So that's what got me into doing a little bit of research. And I had the great honor of meeting two such elite climbers. One of them, in fact, is an old colleague of mine from Switzerland. His name is Georg Flepp. And, you know, while he was working within the energy industry, in parallel, he was also working as a mountain guide throughout the entire Alpine region, including the iconic mountain, which is perched just off the very charming Swiss village of Zermatt in South Switzerland. It's right at the border between Italy and Switzerland. And he was a mountain guide on the Matterhorn. And Lisa, if nothing else, for once in your life, go and see this mountain and spend 2-3 days there. People have told me it has changed their lives. It has materially shifted their thinking, you know, because you can just sense the divinity up there. And I've sensed it at other places like Mount Fuji. And then there are very famous mountains like Mount Kailash, which are holy sites, you know, people do pilgrimages there. Now, the second person I met was a retired army colonel, and he had been part of the first recorded successful summit of Mount Everest in 1953. He was part of the base team of Norgay and Hillary, and he told me that he had lost a couple of toes to frostbite. Now, when I put these two gents together, the back of my mind, what I found is that both individuals were very refined, quiet, dignified, something very spiritual about each one of them and very strong physically. You know, they were not big guys they were not the gymnasium types, but there was an inherent physical toughness and obviously mental born of nature. And I also saw this when, with people who go chasing down the Great Plains of Tornado Alley, there's a certain weathered look, there's a certain toughness, there's a body tone. It's remarkable. You know, it's an energy in its own right. So clearly this was worth investigating because I could see the similarities of both people. Now, what did I find through my subsequent questioning and research? That these extreme environments, they force a level of precision that you rarely experience anywhere else. And it also unlocks metacognition. They aren't just climbing. They are actively thinking about how they think under extreme duress. And this is given in scriptures that when you observe your own mind, it opens up a knowledge portal which serves as the ultimate tool for survival and excellence. So these, when I spoke with both, they said that they deal in two types of risks. This is how they quantify risks. They have what you call acceptable risks, which I would say is, oh, dear Lord, keep me away, right? And then they've got non-acceptable risks. But the acceptable risks, examples are storms that are monitored, timed, and factored into the strategy of climbing. Or understanding team skill set. Again, there it is. You know, the one large mind where you are pushing boundaries within the actual skill level of the climbing party. And if you see other documentaries on these great climbers, you will see how these teams, how they come together, how they live as one, they think as brothers, you know, this, and they look out for each other. You know, you see the same story in battlefields. You know, you can see the parallels. Now, the non-acceptable risks are blind faith, summit fever, ignoring red flags, the fear of missing out on opportunities, trying to compete with younger climbers who may have better technology. And so what happens is in the latter case, again, it's ego over reality that sets in. And I even heard that there are some climbers who fall in love with their own image. You know, I'm the guy who climbs or conquers mountains. And that can lead to disaster. Now, coming back to these, to those who actually truly achieve reality, you know, they conquer their ego. These magnificent men and women, they deal in so many variables along the way, you know, from injuries to loss of friends to self-doubts, and they come back to achieve again. This time, monitoring their abilities and most importantly, their growing limitations. Because as you get older, you know, you have to be very careful because you can injure yourself and you can injure others. And this came straight from, you know, from the two climbers who have achieved, you know, at the highest levels. And sometimes, Lisa, this motivation goes even further. It goes into altruism. And you may have heard of the 2008 Mount K2 disaster where the Irish climber, Ger McDonald, there are serials out there. He refused to leave ailing Korean climbers above the dead zone. He died up there with them. He refused, in his mind, as you know, through subsequent interviews, you know, his family and friends were saying that he could never have lived with himself if he had left another climber up there. I mean, think of that level of human being that you're dealing with. Or you may have heard of the 1996 Everest disaster with Rob Hall. And while it is said that Rob compromised his own safety standards for a friend who had come back to try the summit for a second time, he made it to the summit and collapsed. This time, Rob refused to leave him, and he died up there also. And Lisa, think about this. His wife, Kay, was expecting their child, and yet this man refused to come down. Now, these are human beings, you know, who have achieved so much that, you know, you have to cheer these people from the rooftops of eternity for all time. You know, it's just wonderful. And as I mentioned, you see these parallels, you know, in battlefields. If you examine World War I, World War II, you look at the Korean War, the Vietnam War, you know, all these great conflicts of the 20th century. You come to see that time and time again, it's buddy-buddy, teamwork, love, brotherhood to get you through challenging circumstances. Again, it's the team concept. But cumulatively, you know, they, through managing these factors, they preclude fear and they turn it into fearlessness.
Do you think, like when someone says that another person is fearless, that there is, you're actually capable of not feeling fear, or is it just learning how to work with the fear?
It is, I would offer, based upon all the discussions I've had with these leaders the world over, you know, who gave me inputs for all my research, that they conquer fear. They face fear, but what they do is they break it down into sections. So when you translate it into sections, you actually forget about the fear. You forget about, you know, what the future could be. You work in the moment. And that's how you're going to win. And this is the secret of success in life, Lisa. Work in the moment. You know, listen to who was the that famous author, Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. That's what this is about. It's about being able to deal, take on your fears, take them head on. And what happens is that you will find that the majority of our fears are transitory when you face it. Because when you face them, fear is always about the future based upon past experiences. So when you take it head on, deal with it, it begins to dissipate within your eyes.
Yeah, quite often we tell a story to ourselves about something that we're afraid of, and we make it so much worse in our mind. And that only happens when we're thinking about it from a future perspective. But if we just sit in the moment and be present, and we always find that the thing that we're afraid of isn't so scary when it happens. It's so interesting how our minds tend to elaborate these things, and we think something terrible is going to happen. So quite often I find myself asking myself the question, like, if I'm afraid, what am I afraid of? And is this logical? Like, what is the worst that can happen? But what is the best case scenario? Okay, now what's somewhere in the middle? And that's usually like where the logical reasoning is. So it's interesting how the brain can elaborate fears.
Yes.
But I think you're right. I think it's based on past experiences and the way that we've been shaped growing up. There's a lot of that in all of this. Can you give the audience some practical advice? If someone listening today is, say, they're afraid to change careers or start a business or leave a relationship or go after what they really want in life, where do you even begin?
It's a great summary question. And again, Lisa, it is all about, first of all, understanding that your fears are transitory. They don't control you. You can control them through the power of your being, because again, there is tremendous resident divinity within each human being. And when you strip away, you know, as they, even from a scriptural perspective, they talk about, you know, us having a mind, ego, intellect at various levels. So what happens is the ego is what you call the base that we, and the ego leads to fear. You know, there's a very intrinsic relationship between these two. But when you apply intellect over ego, you now begin to rationalize where you are, what you can do, the situation that I'm stuck in. You know, for example, if you look at the training of special forces the world over, they're not trained to sit down and lament, oh, I'm stuck. They accept where they are and they work from there. And in their training, their mindset is such, they are trained in such a way, Lisa, that dying is just a normal part of the job. Uh-huh. Now think about, I mean, that is the ultimate fear, right? But yet, through mental training, they have eliminated that type of fear. They simply focus in the moment. But again, focusing in the moment also includes having a strategic vision for what it is that you really want to achieve. So if you can take this living in the moment and combine that with strategic vision, where do I want to be in 2-3 years? This is my mindset. So what if you don't make it, but at least you've tried? There are no regrets. You know, this goes back to the entire podcast. So live in the moment and have a strategic vision and work through it. And don't blame others. Blame yourself. Take responsibility. Start from your center and you will begin to tap into this tremendous strength that lies within each one of us. And that is the process called transcendence.
This has been such a really great conversation. I really believe that if we are present and authentic and tell the truth and are honest, that you can't go wrong. That's fear disappears because you're just going through life in the present moment without ruminating about the past or thinking about the future and what we want to happen. I feel like every single time I've tried to control a scenario, I've been met with so much resistance, and it happens time and time again. Like, I mean, I learn every single day, but letting go and just going with the flow and only controlling what you can control, which is typically ourselves, I feel like helps in all of those situations. Deepak, tell everyone more about the work that you do and where they can find more information about you. Tell everyone about your book.
So it's really interesting. So first of all, Lisa, thank you for, you know, this wonderful session. I'll give a couple of takeaway points, but the book itself is on, you know, it's on Amazon and on other multiple platforms. What has been really interesting is that somebody asked, you know, it was really something. There was a senior executive at General Electric who, you know, who bought the book, and he told me, he said, Deepak, I read two pages and I ran for my life. He says, because you sent me down avenues of thought that I've never done. And I said, well, my apologies, but there's about 25,000 plus pages of research in that book compressed into 300 pages. So it's very high compression ratio of information, almost 80 pages to one. But what that led into, Lisa, was very interesting that, you know, people asked me to speak about the book. And that led into this training series that I've developed, the Techno-Spiritual, because it all starts from the roots of my journey was an engineer experientially analyzing divinity. And I was going to leave nothing to chance until I figured out, you know, how the system worked. And there were so many derivative outputs out of it. So I now set up a website called ParashaAdvisory.com. I've begun to now start teaching this Techno-Spiritual Billionaire series, and I'm expanding that into the public space. But just, you know, you made such wonderful points, Lisa. I want to briefly mention that there is an intrinsic relationship, and this applies to everybody, and an intrinsic relationship between fear, desire, and anger. And what happens is that when we desire something, we develop a fear of losing it. And with that comes consequent anger. And that leads to inner tension. So if you learn, you know, through this, you know, through what we have discussed in the podcast, live in the moment, have a strategic vision, you begin to control fear. And that now serves as a catalyst for personal growth, self-discovery, transformation, and transcendence.
Yeah, that's a really great point. We should do another episode on attachment, because I think that's an important point that you just made, that if we attach to an outcome or attach to a scenario or even an object, fear comes in and then we react to it because we don't want to lose it because we have some kind of attachment to it. But a topic for another day for sure.
Yes, we'll do that. Lisa, just one last thing. You know, this whole podcast has been about fear and fearlessness. And I just wanted to dedicate my thoughts to a Vietnam veteran who just passed away recently in Florida 3 weeks back. His name was John Barrowden. He taught me a lot about conquering fear, you know, and he was one of the bravest souls that I've ever encountered in my life. So I just wanted to, you know, wish him, you know, all the blessings that the universe can give him. And thank you for everything he did for me.
Well, thank you so much for showing up today and for having such a great conversation. What is your hope that the audience takes from today's conversation?
Look fear in the eye. Turn it into fearlessness. When you start doing that, you take and you just begin to cut it down, deal with it in sections. You will, and the more you think about it, the more you will be able to, without ego, without emotion, live in the moment, and you will start to see a pathway. And when you are in trouble, if you cannot get an answer, shout, scream for help, communicate. People will show up to help.
Thank you so much, Deepak. This has been an amazing conversation. And I also want to thank our lovely audience for tuning in. Fear will always knock on your door, but the question is, who is going to answer that door? And so today's conversation reminds us that courage isn't reserved for extraordinary people. It's built through ordinary decisions made one brave step at a time. So again, Deepak, thank you for sharing your wisdom and showing us that fear doesn't have to define our future. It can literally become the doorway to our greatest growth. And to everyone listening, do not wait until you're fearless to take action. Sometimes the very act of taking the first step is what creates that fearlessness that you've been searching for. We're going to have Deepak's information in the show notes for you to have access to his website, his program, his book, and anything else that he can share with you. And again, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Stay tuned for the next episode. Take care, everyone. Be fearless.